Chapter 8, The Denouement of the Creative Process, or the Outcome. Then comes the question, what should logically be the denouement of the progression we have been considering? Let us briefly recapitulate the steps of the series. Universal Spirit, by self-contemplation, evolves universal substance. From this, it produces cosmic creation as the expression of itself as functioning in space and time. Then, from this initial movement, it proceeds to more highly specialized modes of self-contemplation in a continually ascending scale, for the simple reason that self-contemplation admits of no limits, and therefore each stage of self-recognition cannot be other than the starting point for a still more advanced mode of self-contemplation, and so on ad infinitum. Thus, there is a continuous progress toward more and more highly specialized forms of life, implying greater liberty and wider scope for enjoyment as the capacity of the individual life corresponds to a higher degree of the contemplation of spirit. And in this way, evolution proceeds till it reaches a level where it becomes impossible to go any further except by the exercise of conscious selection and initiative on the part of the individual, while at the same time conforming to the universal principles of which evolution is the expression. Now ask yourself in what way individual selection and initiative would be likely to act as expressing the originating spirit itself. Given the knowledge on the part of the individual that he is able, by his power of initiative and selection, to draw directly upon the all-originating spirit of life, what motive could he have for not doing so? Therefore, granted such a perfect recognition, we should find the individual holding precisely the same place in regard to his own individual world that the all-originating spirit does to the cosmos, subject only to the same law of love, beauty, etc., which we found to be necessarily inherent in the creative spirit, a similarity which would entirely prevent the individual from exercising his otherwise limitless powers in any sort of antagonism to the spirit of the great whole. At the same time, the individual would be quite aware that he was not the universal spirit in propria persona, or in his own self, but that he was affording expression to it through his individuality. Now, expression is impossible except through form, and therefore form of some sort is a necessity of individuality. It is just here, then, that we find the importance of that principle of harmony with environment of which I spoke earlier, the principle in accordance with which a person who had obtained complete control of matter, if he wished to transport himself to some other planet, would appear there in perfect conformity with all the laws of matter that obtained in that world, though, of course, not subject to any limitation of the life principle in himself. He would exhibit the laws of matter as rendered perfect by the law of originating life. But if anyone now living on this earth were thus perfectly to realize the law of life, he would be in precisely the same position here as our imaginary visitor to another planet. In other words, the denouement, the result of the law of life, is not the putting off of the body, but its inclusion as part of the conscious life of the spirit. This does not imply any difference in the molecular structure of the body from that of other men, for by the principle of harmony of which I have just spoken, it would be formed in strict accordance with the laws of matter on the particular planet, though it would not be subject to the limitations resulting from the average man's non-recognition of the power of the spirit. The man who had thus fully entered into the fifth kingdom would recognize that, in its relation to the denser modes of matter, his body was of a similar dense mode. That would be its relation to external environment as seen by others. But since the man now knew himself as not belonging to these denser modes of manifestation, but as an individualization of primary spirit, he would see that, relatively to himself, all matter was primary substance, and that from this point of view, any condensations of that subject into atoms, molecules, tissues, and the like counted for nothing. For him, the body would be simply primary substance, entirely responsive to his will. Yet, his reverence for the law of harmony would prevent any disposition to play psychic pranks with it, and he would use his power over the body only to meet actual requirements. In this way, then, we are led to the conclusion that eternal life in an immortal physical body is the logical denouement of our evolution, and if we reflect that, by the conditions of the case, the owners of such bodies could at will either transport themselves to other worlds or put off the physical body altogether and remain in purely subjective life while still retaining the power to reclothe themselves in flesh whenever they chose, we shall see that this denouement of evolution answers all possible questions as to the increase of the race, the final destruction of the planet, and the like. This, then, is the ultimate, which we should keep in view. But the fact remains that, though there may be hidden ones who have thus attained, the bulk of mankind have not, and that the common lot of humanity is to go through the change which we call death. In broad philosophical terms, death may be described as the withdrawal of the life into the subjective consciousness, to the total exclusion of the objective consciousness. Then, by the general law of the relation between the subjective and the objective mind, the subjective mind, severed from its corresponding objective mentality, has no means of acquiring fresh impressions on its own account, and therefore can only ring the changes on those impressions which it has brought with it from its past life. But these may be of various sorts, ranging from the lowest to the highest, from those most opposed to that ultimate destiny of man which we have just been considering, to those which recognize his possibilities in a very large measure, needing little more to bring about the full fruition of perfected life. But however various may be their experiences, all who have passed through death must have this in common, that they have lost their physical instrument of objective perception, and so have their mode of consciousness determined entirely by the dominant mode of suggestion which they have brought over with them from the objective side of life. Of course, if the objective mentality were also brought over, this would give the individual the same power of initiative and selection that he possesses while in the body. And as we shall see later on, there are exceptional persons with whom this is the case. But for the great majority, the physical brain is a necessity for the working of the objective mentality. And so, when they are deprived of this instrument, their life becomes purely subjective and is a sort of dream life, only with a vast difference between two classes of dreamers, those who dream as they must and those who dream as they will. The former are those who have enslaved themselves in various ways to their lower mentality, some by bringing with them the memory of crimes unpardoned, some by bringing with them the idea of a merely animal life, others, less degraded but still in bondage to limited thought, bringing with them only the suggestion of a frivolous worldly life. In this way, by the natural operation of the law of suggestion, these different classes, either through remorse or unsatisfied desires or sheer incapacity to grasp higher principles, all remain earthbound, suffering in exact correspondence with the nature of the suggestion they have brought along with them. The unchangeable law is that the suggestion becomes the life. And this is equally true of suggestions of a happier sort. Those who have brought over with them the great truth that conditions are the creations of thought, and who have accustomed themselves while in objective life to dwell on good and beautiful ideas, are still able, by reason of being imbued with this suggestion, to mold the conditions of their consciousness in the subjective world in accordance with the sort of ideas which have become a second nature to them. Within the limits of these ideas, the dominant suggestion to these entities is that of a law which confers liberty. So by using this law of the constructive power of thought, they can determine the conditions of their own consciousness, and thus, instead of being compelled to suffer the nightmare dreams of the other class, they can mold their dream according to their will. We cannot conceive of such a life as theirs in the unseen as otherwise than happy. Nevertheless, its range is limited by the range of the conceptions they have brought with them. These may be exceedingly beautiful and thoroughly true and logical as far as they go, but they do not go the whole way. Otherwise, these spirits would not be in the category which we are considering, but would belong to that still higher class who fully realize the ultimate possibilities which the law of the expression of spirit provides. The otherwise happy subjective life of these more enlightened souls has this radical defect, that they have failed to bring over with them that power of original selection and initiative without which further progress is impossible. I wish the student to grasp this point very clearly, for it is of the utmost importance. Of course, the basis of our further evolution is conformity to the harmonious nature of the originating spirit. But upon this foundation, we each have to build up the superstructure of our own individuality, and every step of advance depends on our personal development of power to take that step. This is what is meant by taking an initiative. It is making a new departure, not merely recombining the old things into fresh groupings, still subject to the old laws, but introducing an entirely new element, which will bring its own new law along with it. Now, if this is the true meaning of initiative, then that is just the power which these otherwise happy souls do not possess. For by the very conditions of the case, they are living only in their subjective consciousness, and consequently are living by the law of subjective mind. And one of the chief characteristics of subjective mind is incapacity to reason inductively, and therefore its inability to make the selection and take the initiative necessary to inaugurate a new departure. The well-established facts of mental law show conclusively that subjective mind argues only deductively. It argues quite correctly from any given premises, but it cannot take the initiative in selecting the premises. That is the province of inductive reasoning, which is essentially the function of the objective mind. But by the law of auto-suggestion, this discarnate individual has brought over his premises with him, which premises are the sum total of his inductions made during objective life, the conception of things which he held at the time he passed over, for this constitutes his idea of truth. Now he cannot add to these inductions, for he has parted with his instrument for inductive reasoning, and therefore his deductive reasoning in the purely subjective state which he has now entered is necessarily limited to the consequences which may be deducted from the premises which he has brought along with him. In the case of the highly developed individualities we are now considering, the premises thus brought over are of a very far-reaching and beautiful character, and consequently the range of their subjective life is correspondingly wide and beautiful, but nevertheless it is subject to the radical defect that it is debarred from further progress for the simple reason that the individual has not brought over with him the mental faculty which can impress his subjective entity with the requisite forward movement for making a new departure into a new order. And, moreover, the higher the subjective development with which the individual passed over, the more likely he will be to realize this defect. If during earth life he had gained sufficient knowledge of these things, he will carry with him the knowledge that his discarnate existence is purely subjective, and therefore he will realize that, however he may be able to order the pictures of his dream, yet it is still but a dream, and, in common with all other dreams, lacks the basis of solidity from which to take really creative action. He knows also that the condition of other discarnate individualities is similar to his own, and that consequently each one must necessarily live in a world apart, a world of his own creation, because none of them possess the objective mentality by which to direct their subjective currents so as to make them penetrate into the sphere of another subjective entity, which is the modus operandi or method of procedure of telepathy. Thus, He is conscious of his own inability to hold intercourse with other personalities, for though he may, for his own pleasure, create the semblance of them in his dream life, yet he knows that these are creations of his own mind, and that while he appears to be conversing with a friend amid the most lovely surroundings, the friend himself may be having experiences of a very different description. I am, of course, speaking now of persons who have passed over in a very high state of development and with a very considerable, though still imperfect, knowledge of the law of their own being. Probably the majority take their dream life for an external reality, and in all case, all who have passed over without carrying their objective mentality along with them must be shut up in their individual subjective spheres and cease to function as centers of creative power, so long as they do not emerge from that state. But the highly advanced individuals of whom I am speaking have passed over with a true knowledge of the law of the relation between subjective and objective mind, and have therefore brought with them a subjective knowledge of this truth, and therefore, however otherwise in a certain sense happy, they must still be conscious of a fundamental limitation which prevents their further advance. And this consciousness can produce only one result, an ever-growing longing for the removal of this limitation. And this represents the intense desire of the spirit, as individualized in these souls, to attain to the conditions under which it can freely exercise its creative power. Subconsciously, this is the desire of all souls, for it is that continual pressing forward of the spirit for manifestation, out of which the whole creative process arises. And so it is that the great cry perpetually ascends to God from all as yet undelivered souls, whether in or out of the body, for the deliverance which they knowingly or unknowingly desire. All this comes out of the well-ascertained facts of the law of relation between subjective and objective mind. Then comes the question, is there no way of getting out of this law? The answer is that we can never get away from universal principles, but we can specialize them. We may take it as an axiom that any law which appears to limit us contains in itself the principle by which that limitation can be overcome, just as in the case of the flotation of iron. In this axiom, then, we shall find the clue which will bring us out of the labyrinth. The same law which places various degrees of limitation upon the souls that have passed into the invisible can be so applied as to set them free. We have seen that everything turns on the obligation of our subjective part to act within the limits of the suggestion which has been most deeply impressed upon it. Then why not impress upon it the suggestion that in passing over to the other side, it has brought a subjective mentality along with it? If such a suggestion were effectively impressed upon our subjective mind, then by the fundamental law of our nature, our subjective mind would act in strict accordance with this suggestion, with the result that the objective mind would no longer be separated from it, and that we should carry with us into the unseen our whole mentality, both subjective and objective, and so be able to exercise our inductive powers of selection and initiative as well there as here. Why not? The answer is that we cannot accept any suggestion unless we believe it to be true. And to believe it to be true, we must feel that we have a solid foundation for our belief. If then we can find a sufficient foundation for adequately impressing this suggestion upon ourselves, then the principles of mental law assure us that we shall carry our objective faculty of initiative and selection into the unseen. Therefore, our quest is to find this foundation. Then, since we cannot accept as true what we would believe to be contrary to the ultimate law of the universe, if we are to find such a foundation at all, it must be within that law. And it is for this reason that I have laid so much stress upon the normal standard of human individuality. When we are convinced that this ideal completeness is quite normal and is a spiritual fact, not dependent upon the body, but able to control the body, then we have got the solid basis on which to carry out, on which to carry our objective personality along with us into the unseen. And the well-established laws of our mental constitution justify the belief that we can do so. From these considerations, it is obvious that those who thus pass over in possession of their complete mentality must be in a very different position from those who pass into a condition of merely subjective life, for they have brought their powers of selection and initiative with them, and can, therefore, employ their experiences in the unseen as a starting point for further development. So then, the question arises, what lines will this further development be likely to follow? We are now considering the case of persons who have reached a very high degree of development, who have succeeded in so completely uniting the subjective and objective portions of their spiritual being into a perfect whole that they can never again be severed, and who are, therefore, able to function with their whole consciousness on the spiritual plane. Such persons will doubtless be well aware that they have attained this degree of development by the law of the creative process working in terms of their own individuality, and so they would naturally always refer to the original cosmic creation as the demonstration of the principle which they have to specialize for their own further evolution. Then they would find that the principle involved is that of the manifestation of spirit in form. And they would further see that this manifestation is not an illusion, but a reality, for the simple reason that both mind and matter are equally projections from the great originating spirit. Both alike are thoughts of the divine mind, and it is impossible to conceive any greater reality than the divine thought, or to get at any more substantial source of reality than that. Even if we were to picture the divine mind as laughing at its productions as being mere illusions relatively to itself, which I certainly do not, still, the relation between the individual mind and material existence would be a reality for the individual on the simple mathematical ground that like signs multiplied together invariably produce a positive result, even though the signs themselves be negative. So that for us, at every stage of our existence, substance must always be as much a reality as mind. Therefore, the manifestation of spirit in form is the eternal principle of the creative process, whether in the evolution of a world system or in that of an individual. But when we realize that, by the nature of the creative process, substance must be an eternal verity, we must not suppose that this is true also of particular forms or of particular modes of matter. Substance is a necessity for the expression of spirit, but it does not follow that spirit is tied down to any particular mode of expression. If you fold a piece of paper into the form of a dart, it will fly through the air by the law of the form which you have given it. Again, if you take the same bit of paper and float it into the shape of a boat, it will float on water by the law of the new form that you have given it. The thing formed will act in accordance with the form given it, and the same paper can be folded into different forms. But if there were no paper, you could not put it into any shape at all. The dart and the boat are both real, as long as you retain the paper in either of those shapes. But this does not alter the fact that you can change the shapes, though your power to do so depends on the existence of paper. This is a rough analogy of the relation between ultimate substance and particular forms, and shows us that neither substance nor shape is an illusion. Both are essential to the manifestation of spirit. Only by the nature of the creative process, the spirit has power to determine what shape substance shall take at any particular time. Accordingly, we find the great law that, as spirit is the alpha of the creative process, so solid material form is its omega. In other words, the creative series is incomplete until solid material form is reached. Anything short of this is a condition of incompleteness, and therefore the enlightened souls who have passed over in possession of both sides of their mentality will realize that their condition, however beatific, is still one of incompleteness, and that what is wanted for completion is expression through a material body. This, then, is the direction in which such souls would use their power of initiative and selection as being the true line of evolution. In a word, they would realize that the principle of creative progression, when it reaches the level of fully developed mental man, necessarily implies the resurrection of the body, and that anything short of this would be retrogression and not progress. At the same time, persons who had passed over with this knowledge would never suppose that resurrection meant merely the resuscitation of the old body under the old conditions. For they would see that the same inherent law which makes expression in concrete substance the ultimate of the creative series also makes this ultimate form depend on the originating movement of the spirit which produces it, and therefore that although some concrete form is essential for complete manifestation and is a substantial reality so long as it is maintained, yet the maintaining of the particular form is entirely dependent on the action of the spirit of which the form is the external clothing. This resurrection body would therefore be no mere illusory spirit shape, yet it would not be subject to the limitations of matter as we now know it. It would be physical matter still, but entirely subject to the will of the indwelling spirit, which would not regard the denser atomic relations of the body, but only its absolute and essential nature as primary substance. I want the student to grasp the idea that the same thing may be very different when looked at, so to say, from opposite ends of the stick. What is solid molecular matter when viewed from the outside is plastic primary substance when viewed from the inside. The relations of this new body to any stimulus proceeding from outside would be those of the external laws of nature. But its relation to the spiritual ego working from within would be that of a plastic substance to be molded at will. The employment of such power would, however, at all times be based upon the reverent worship of the all-creating spirit, and it would, therefore, never be exercised otherwise than in accordance with the harmonious progress of the creative process. Proceeding on these lines, the spirit in the individual would stand in precisely the same relation to his body that the all-originating spirit does to the cosmos. This, then, is the sort of body which the instructed would contemplate as that in which he was to attain resurrection. He would regard it not as an illusion, but as a great reality, while at the same time he would not need to trouble himself about its particular form, for he would know that it would be the perfect expression of his own conception of himself. He would know this because it is in accordance with the fundamental principle that external creation has its root in the self-contemplation of spirit. Those passing over with this knowledge would obviously be in a very different position from those who passed over with only a subjective consciousness. They would bring with them powers of selection and initiative by which they could continue to impress fresh and expanding conceptions upon their subjective mind, and so cause it to carry on its work as the seed ground of the whole individuality, instead of being shut up in itself as a mere circulus for the repetition of previously received ideas. And so, in their recognition of the principle of physical resurrection, they would have a clear and definite line of auto-suggestion. And because this suggestion is derived from the undeniable facts of the whole cosmic creation, it is one which both subjective and objective mind can accept as an established fact. And so, the suggestion becomes effective. This suggestion then becomes the self-contemplation of the individual spirit. And because it is in strict conformity with the generic principle of the original creative activity, of which the individual mind is itself a product, This becomes also the self-contemplation of the originating spirit as seeing itself reflected in the individual spirit, so that by the basic law of the creative process, this suggestion is bound sooner or later to work out into its corresponding fact, namely, the production of a material body free from the power of death and from all those limitations which we now associate with our physical organism. This then is the hope of those who pass over in recognition of the great truth. But how about those who have passed over without that recognition? We have seen that their purely subjective condition precludes them from taking any initiative on their own account, for that requires the presence of objective mind. Their subjective mind, however, still retains its essential nature. That is, it is still susceptible to suggestion and still possesses its inherent creativeness in working out any suggestion that is sufficiently deeply implanted in it. Here then opens up a vast field of activity for the other class who have passed over in possession of both sides of their mentality. By means of their powers of initiative and selection, they can, on the principle of telepathy, cause their own subjective mind to penetrate the subjective spheres of those who do not possess those powers. And they can thus endeavor to impress upon them the great truth of the physical ultimate of the creative process. The truth that any series which stops short of that ultimate is incomplete, and if insisted upon as being ultimate, must become self-destructive because in opposition to the inherent working of the universal creative spirit. Then, as the perception of the true nature of the creative process dawned upon any subjective entity, it would, by reason of accepting this suggestion, begin to develop an objective mentality, and so would gradually attain to the same status as those who had passed over in full possession of all their mental powers. But the more the objective mentality became developed in these discarnate personalities, the more the need of a corresponding physical instrument would assert itself, both from their intellectual perception of the original cosmic process and also from the inherent energy of the spirit as centered in the ultimate ego of the individual. Not to seek material manifestation would be the contrary of all we have traced out regarding the nature of the creative process, and hence the law of tendency resulting from the conscious union of subjective and objective mind in the individual must necessarily be toward the production of a physical form. Only we must recollect, as I have already pointed out, that this concentration of these minds would be upon a principle and not upon a particular bodily shape. The particular form they would be content to leave to the inherent self-expressiveness of the universal spirit working through the particular ego, with the result that their expectation would be fixed upon a general principle of physical resurrection, which would provide a form suited to be the material instrument of the highest ideal of man as a spiritual and mental being. Then, since the subjective mind is the automatic builder of the body, the result of the individual's acceptance of this resurrection principle must be that this mental conception will eventually work out as a corresponding fact. Whether on this planet or some other matters not, for as we have already seen, the physical body evolved by a soul that is conscious of its unity with the universal spirit is bound to be in conformity with the physical laws of any planet, though from the standpoint of the conscious ego, not limited by them. In this way, we may conceive that those who have passed over in possession of both sides of their spiritual nature would find a glorious field of usefulness in the unseen, in helping to emancipate those who had passed over only in possession of their subjective side. But from our present analysis, it will be seen that this can only be effected on the basis of a recognition of the principle of the resurrection of the body. Apart from the recognition of this principle, the only possible conception which the discarnate individual could form of himself wouldn't be that of a purely subjective being, and this carries with it all the limitations of a subjective life unbalanced by an objective one. And so long as the principle of physical resurrection is denied, so long the life must continue to be merely subjective and consequently unprogressive. Footnote. This view, it may be remarked, is not necessarily incompatible with the concept of reincarnation, on which theory the final resurrection or transmutation of the body would terminate the series of successive lives and deaths, thus bringing the individual out of the circle of generation, which is the circle of karma. I may perhaps have the opportunity of considering this subject on some future occasion. End of footnote. But it may be asked why those who have realized this great principle sufficiently to carry their objective mentality into the unseen state are liable to the change which we call death. The answer is that though they have realized the general principle, they have not yet divested themselves of certain conceptions by which they limit it, and consequently, by the law of subjective mind, they carry those limitations into the working of the resurrection principle itself. They are limited by the race belief that physical death is, under all conditions, a necessary law of nature, or by the theological belief that death is the will of God. So then the question is whether these beliefs are well-founded. Of course, appeal is made to universal experience, but it does not follow that the universal experience of the past is bound to be the universal experience of the future. The universal experience of the past was that no man had ever flown across the English Channel, yet now it has been done. What we have to do, therefore, is not bother about past experience, but to examine the inherent nature of the law of life and see whether it does not contain possibilities of further development. And the first step in this direction is to see whether what we have hitherto considered limitations of the law are really integral parts of the law itself. The very statement of this question shows the correct answer. For how can a force acting in one direction be an integral part of a force acting in the opposite direction? How can the force which pulls a thing down be an integral part of the force which builds it up? To suppose, therefore, that the limitations of the law are an integral portion of the law itself is a reductio ad absurdum, or yields an absurdity. For these reasons, the argument from the past experience of the race counts for nothing. And when we examine the theological argument, we shall find that it is only the old argument from past experience in another dress. It is alleged that death is the will of God. How do we know that it is the will of God? Because the facts prove it so, is the ultimate answer of all religious systems, with one exception. So here we are, back again, at the old race experience as the criterion of truth. Therefore, the theological argument is nothing but the materialistic argument disguised. It is in our more or less conscious acceptance of the materialistic argument under any of its many disguises that the limitation of life is to be found, not in the law of life itself. And if we are to bring into manifestation the infinite possibilities latent in that law, it can only be by looking steadily into the principle of the law and resolutely denying everything that opposes it. The principle of life must of necessity be affirmative, and affirmative throughout, without any negative anywhere. If we once realize this, we shall be able to unmask the enemy and silence his guns. Now, to do this precisely, is precisely the one object of the Bible, and it does it in a thoroughly logical manner, always leading on to the ultimate result by successive links of cause and effect. People will tell you that the Bible is their authority for saying that death is the will of God, but these are people who read it carelessly. And ultimately, the only reason they can give you for their manner of interpreting the Bible is that the facts prove their interpretation to be correct, so that in the last resort, you will always find you've got back to the old materialistic argument from past race experience, which logically proves nothing. These are good, well-meaning people with a limited idea, which they read into the Bible, and so limit its promises by making physical death an essential primary to resurrection. They grasp, of course, the great central idea that perfected man possesses a joyous, immortal, life-permeating spirit, soul, and body. But they relegate it to some dim and distant future, entirely disconnected from the present law of our being, not seeing that if we are to have eternal life, it must necessarily be involved in some principle which is eternal and therefore existing, at any rate latently, at the present moment. Hence, though their fundamental principle is true, they are all the time mentally limiting it, with the result that they themselves create the conditions they impose upon it. And consequently, the principle will work, as principles always do, in accordance with the conditions provided for its action. Unless, therefore, this limiting belief is entirely eradicated, the individual, through realizing the fundamental principle of life, is bound to pass out of physical existence. But, on the other hand, since he does take the recognition of this fundamental principle with him, it is bound to bear fruit sooner or later in a joyous resurrection, while the intermediate state can only be a peaceful anticipation of that supreme event. This is the answer to the question why those who have realized the great principle sufficiently to carry their objective mentality into the unseen world are still liable to physical death. And in the last analysis, it will be found to resolve itself into the remains of race belief based on past experience. These are they who pass over in sure and certain hope of a glorious resurrection, sure and certain, because founded upon the very being of God Himself, that inherent life of the all-creating divine spirit, which is the perpetual interaction of the eternal love and beauty. They have grasped the life-giving truth, only they have postponed its operation because they have the fixed idea that its present fruition is an absolute impossibility. But if we ask the reason for this idea, it always comes back to the old materialistic argument from the experience of past conditions. While the whole nature of advance is in the opening up of new conditions, and in this advance, the Bible is the pioneer book. Its whole purport is to tell us most emphatically that death is not the will of God. In the story of Eden, God is represented as warning man of the poisonous nature of the forbidden fruit, which is incompatible with the idea of death as an essential feature of man's nature. Then, from the point where man has taken the poison, all the rest of the Bible is devoted to telling us how to get rid of it. Christ, it tells us, was manifested to bring life and immortality to light, to abolish death, to destroy the works of the devil, that is, the death-dealing power. For, quote, he that hath the power of death is the devil, end quote. It is impossible to reconcile this life-giving conception of the Bible with the idea that death at any stage or in any degree is the desire of God. Let us therefore start with the recognition that this negative force, whether in its minor degrees as disease or in its culmination as death, is that which it is the will of God to abolish. This is also logical. For if God be the universal spirit of life, finding manifestation in individual lives, how can the desire of this spirit be to act in opposition to its own manifestation? Therefore, scripture and common sense alike assure us that the will of God toward us is life and not death. We may certainly start on our quest for life with the happy certainty that God is on our side. But people will meet us with the objection that though God wills life to us, he does not will it just yet, but only in some dim, far-off future. How do we know this? Certainly not from the Bible. In the Bible, Jesus talks of two classes of persons who believe on him as a manifestation or individualization of the spirit of life. He speaks of those who, having passed through death, still believe in him, and he says that these shall live a future event. And at the same time, he speaks of those who are living and believe on him and says that they shall never die, thus contemplating the entire elimination of the contingency of death. John 11:25. Again, St. Paul expresses his wish not to be unclothed, but to be clothed upon, which he certainly would not have done had he considered the latter alternative a nonsensical fancy. And in another place, he expressly states that we shall not all die, but that some shall be transmuted into the resurrection body without passing through physical death. And if we turn to the Old Testament, we find two instances in which this is said to have actually occurred, those of Enoch and Elijah. And we may note in passing that the Bible draws our attention to certain facts about these two personages, which are important as striking at the root of the notion that austerities of some sort are necessary for the great attainment. Of Enoch, we are expressly told that he was the father of a large family, and of Elijah, that he was a man of like nature with ourselves, thus showing us what is wanted is not a shutting off of ourselves, off from ordinary human life, but such a clear realization of the universal principle of which our personal life is the more or less conscious manifestation, that our commonest actions will be hallowed by the divine presence, and so the grand denouement will be only the natural result of our daily habit of walking with God. From the standpoint of the Bible, therefore, the attainment of physical regeneration without passing through death is not an impossibility, nor is it necessarily relegated to some far-off future. Whatever anyone else may say to the contrary, the Bible contemplates such a denouement or outcome of human evolution as a present possibility. Then, if we argue from the philosophical standpoint, we arrive at precisely the same result. Past experience proves nothing. And we must, therefore, make a fresh start by going back to the original creative action of the spirit of life itself. Then, if we take this as our starting point, remembering that at the stage of this original movement, there can be no intervention by a second power, because there is none, why should we mentally impose any restriction upon the action of the creative power? Certainly not by its own law of tendency, for that must always be toward fuller self-expression. And since this can only take place through the individual, the desire of the spirit must always be toward the increasing of the individual life. Nor yet from anything that created substance, for that would be either to suppose the spirit creating something in limitation of its own self-expression, or else to suppose that the limiting substance was created by some other power working against the spirit. And as this would mean a duality of powers, we should not have reached the originating power at all. And so we might put spirit and substance equally out of court as both being merely modes of secondary causation. But if we see that the universal substance must be created by emanation from the universal spirit, then we see that no limitation of spirit by substance is possible. We may therefore feel assured that no limitation proceeds either from the will of the spirit or from the nature of substance. Where, then, does limitation come from? Limiting conditions are created by the same power which creates everything else, namely, the self-contemplation of spirit. That is why it is so important to realize that the individual mind forms a center from which the self-contemplating action of spirit is specialized in terms of the individual's own mode of thinking. And therefore, so long as the individual contemplates negative conditions as being of the essence of his own personality, he is, in effect, employing the creative power of the self-contemplation of spirit invertedly, destructively, instead of constructively. The law of the self-contemplation of spirit as the creative power is as true in the microcosm as in the macrocosm. And so the individual's contemplation of himself as subject to the law of sin and death keeps him subject to that law. While the opposite self-contemplation, the contemplation of himself as rejoicing in the life of the Spirit, the perfect law of liberty must necessarily produce the opposite results. Why then should not regeneration be accomplished here and now? Well, I can see no reason against it, either scriptural or philosophical, except our own difficulty in getting rid of the race traditions which are so deeply embedded in our subjective minds. To get rid of these, we require a firm basis on which to receive the opposite suggestion. We need to be convinced that our idea of a regenerated self is in accord with the normal standard of humanity and is within the scope of the laws of the universe. Now, to make clear to us the infinitude of the truly normal standard of humanity is the whole purpose of the Bible, and the manifestation of this standard is set before us in the central personality of the scriptures, who is at once the Son of God and the Son of Man, the great exception, if you will, to man as we know him now, but the exception which proves the rule. In proportion as we begin to realize this, we begin to introduce into our own life the action of that personal factor on which all further development depends. And when our recognition is complete, we shall find that we also are children of God. End of chapter.